Hey everyone, welcome to the Behind the Scenes podcast. I'm Jeremy.
And I'm Audrey.
And on this podcast, we share the messy, honest, unfiltered, and not so curated parts of our life.
Think of this podcast as a bunch of bloopers with some truth bombs sprinkled throughout.
That's right. We're going to be taking you behind the scenes of our daily routines, our social media feeds, and what you may or may not have seen on TV.
We're going to be talking relationships, family, faith, business, basically whatever we are learning about, fighting about, or laughing about lately.
We're going to be sharing our daily life, our struggles, successes, and our roses and thorns from each week.
And we don't want this podcast to just be about us, so we're also going to go behind the scenes with some of the people who inspire us the most.
We hope this podcast feels like you're joining us for a campfire.
Come hang out. We are so excited to have our first guest on the Behind the Scenes podcast, Christopher Hewerts. And the reason we're so excited to have him on the podcast is because he is an Enneagram expert. And if you guys have been following Jeremy and I for any length of time, you know how much we have been just in love with the Enneagram and obsessed with the Enneagram for the past year. And so Chris is bringing his expertise on the Enneagram to the show. He's trained under some of the great Enneagram masters, including Father Richard Rohr, Russ Hudson, Marion Gilbert, and Helen Palmer. And he now teaches the Enneagram in workshops and retreats around the world. Chris is an International Enneagram Association accredited professional, and him and his wife, Felina, and their puppy, Basil, live in Omaha. You are going to love this episode, and I think that your eyes will really be open to probably just a lot of things about yourself, and it might cause you to do some soul searching. So we're excited to have Chris on the show, and we know you're going to love this.
All right. We are sitting here with Chris Hewerts, the author of The Sacred Enneagram. Chris, we're really excited to jump into this conversation today. Audge and I have been kind of falling over the Enneagram for a couple months now, and we're just super excited to have you on and really kind of dive into it a little more.
Thanks so much for including me. Great to be with you too.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So I think we'll start out with just kind of a couple kind of 30,000 foot questions. I don't want to spend too much time on kind of the, because anyone can go Google and, search and read your book and kind of get a good view of the Enneagram, but we'll just kind of debrief what it is a little bit here. So babe, you want to?
Yeah. Well, first, Chris, I mean, we just love to give you the opportunity to give us a little background on like who you are and how you fell into the Enneagram and just give our listeners a taste of you and your life and your passion.
Yeah, well, I live in Omaha, Nebraska with my wife, Felina, and we adopted a puppy a couple years ago, named him Basil, and we're a happy family of three here.
Nice.
For 20 years, Felina and I were part of an international humanitarian organization, and we lived and worked and traveled all around the world. And the group that we are part of primarily was focusing on the anti-human trafficking movement and working with children who had been impacted by the global AIDS pandemic. And so right out of college, I moved to India and helped, this is in the mid-1990s, helped start the first pediatric AIDS care home in South Asia, the first home in those eight countries.
Wow.
For kids who are orphaned because of AIDS or were born HIV positive or were sick themselves. It was a great time of my life, as well as a time of tremendous suffering, because we were burying quite a few little kids who had a really rough go, and to see such innocent and tender little hearts and bodies struggle and endure so much was overwhelming.
How old were you?
Wow.
If this was straight out of college, you said, right?
Yeah, I was 22 years old.
Oh my
wow.
God.
And so it was
that's a lot to process and take in.
Yes. And in addition to that, when I would get out of the city, I was living in South India. I'd go up to Calcutta in the north, and then do some volunteer work with Mother Teresa and the Missionaries of Charity, and actually would spend quite a bit of time in her house for the dying, which was essentially hospice for folks that they had found in
that's
slums and streets and train stations. So there was a lot going on in my early 20s with this work.
Yeah.
Wow. I that's really neat. Mother, I mean, you know, spending time with Mother Teresa, that's
what a remarkable thing.
Yeah, what a remarkable thing to be able to say.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, she was remarkable.
Spending time with her, you know, under the circumstances was, I'm sure, tough just given the circumstances, mm-hmm. but nonetheless, what a opportunity. It's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like all good mentors, of course, you know this, I learned more from watching her than actually the things she said and mm-hmm. shared with me. I mean, she really lived into
awesome.
Her values. So.
Do what I awesome. Do, not what I say. If yeah. That's just such a cool thing, legacy for someone to say about her.
Yeah. So how did you fall into Enneagram and all of that and come to write your now book, Sacred Enneagram?
Yeah. So we were part of that organization for 20 years and my wife and I became the co-directors of that and we built it out. It was pretty robust. It was really community focused and, you know, we were really, the work was hard. You can imagine the work was difficult, but I think what surprised a lot of us was sometimes the most difficult aspect of what we were doing was living and working in community, trying to get along with each other, trying to, mm-hmm. to resolve our differences and fight fair and learn how to not take just, you know, the beauty of our flawed humanity personally, but to make room for it. And so I was visiting a friend who was working in the slums in Cambodia. We were having lunch one afternoon. This is about 20 years ago, actually. Hmm. And he actually asked me, have I ever heard of this thing called the Enneagram? And I hadn't. And as he began to describe this to me, of course, I pushed back. I was like, this isn't real. You're making this up, man. Yeah. And he kept at me, but I wouldn't take it. So I was traveling back to the States. I stopped in Long Beach to see a friend. I was sitting at his desk trying to sort of sift through my jet lag. I got online and took as many of the online tests that I could back then. Averaged out all the results, sent them to my friend back in Phnom Penh. And he was like, man, you're doing this wrong. And he asked me a question and very specifically, it was about how I related to my mother. And what he was doing was he was sort of holding up the so-called childhood wounds of the Enneagram as sort of a mirror to myself to help me maybe discern or bring forward my type. Well, at that moment, everything changed. And the Enneagram became a real important tool in our community. But it was still years later that I finally began to train, started training with Father Richard Rohr, who's a Franciscan friar in New Mexico. And then started to pick up advanced trainings at the Enneagram Institute and in the narrative tradition.
Wow. So you like dove right in.
It took me a minute, but yeah, when I said yes, I started chasing down all the great living teachers. And so I've trained and studied under Sandra Maitrey and Michael Goldberg and Beatrice Chestnut, Helen Palmer and Russ Hudson. It's been a real gift.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so
such a crazy life
so
story.
I think before we even hear more, what give us a brief overview of kind of what the Enneagram is, you know, so
a lot of people that are listening to this podcast have never heard of it or don't know how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
But so like 30,000 feet
hearing
view.
The brief 30,000 foot view definition from you I think would be really beneficial. So why don't you give that for us?
For sure. So first of all, even the word itself, Enneagram, it actually comes from two Greek words, ennea, which is the number for nine, and gram, which is where we pull an English diagram. And so it's a nine-pointed or nine-aspected illustrated image or diagram.
Okay.
Now, what the Enneagram has become in the last 45 years has become a human character structure tool. What we're specifically working with, most of us, in 2018 is the Enneagram of personality. We're taking an overlay and we're saying, actually, this tradition, this teaching, this old symbol that for maybe centuries, if not millennia, was actually a process teaching, process tool. When you bring it into how we look at our sense of self, how we look at who we think we are, how we try to understand our personality as the masks that we wear, well, then the Enneagram of personality says that there's nine ways of becoming the most beautiful version of ourselves. There's nine ways that we all suffer not being loved and the ways that we want to be loved. And that there's nine ways that we've forgotten who we are, that we've forgotten our essence and the gift and the purpose of our presence and being.
Mm. So it's a tool for understanding, right? Self-reflecting, right?
Mm-hmm. Self-reflecting, but really, I would say self-remembering, right?
Ooh, interesting.
We're all born to bring a gift forward into the world.
Yeah.
But at a certain point in our infancy, we lost contact, we lost touch with that. And if we can understand that gift that we were born with is really the raw material of our essence, our true self, then what the Enneagram tries to show us is that we've all lost contact with our gift, with our essence. And then we spend the rest of our life suffering that loss of contact. And how do we suffer? Well, we create identities, personalities, masks that we fasten to our sense of self to keep us stuck or lost or blinded.
Yeah. Yeah, which is why this is such
a
valuable tool, because it brings, correct me if I'm wrong, but it brings us back to who not only we are, but who we were created to be.
The best version of ourselves.
But right. you got to go through a lot to get there. But
you have to be willing to do the legwork.
I love Chris.
I mean, if you could, I know this is probably, you might have done this 1,000 times, you probably have, but if you could just give like a quick one sentence overview of each number so our listeners can kind of like at least get just a summary of like the different types.
Yeah.
Sure. So there's a couple of ways that we can run around the circle and look at these nine types and this, even this language type, this word type, it's speaking to one of the, let's say the impressions of human character structure or personality styles. Hmm. Now, when I learned this, I learned this really from my first teacher, Father Richard Rohr, and he had learned this from the Jesuits. And in the early days of the Enneagram of personality, the Jesuits would frame it like this. Type one is the need to be perfect. Type two is the need to be needed. Type three is the need to succeed. Type four is the need to be unique. Type five is the need to understand. Type six is the need to be secure. Type seven is the need to avoid pain. Type eight is the need to be against. And type nine is the need to avoid.
Hmm. Oh, man.
That's a good way to...
So those are really brief, really...
Yeah, totally.
High-level kind of things. And in Audrey's and my research, you know, like, we've... It's just, you know, those are super high level, but man, can you get deep into these. So we've found that, well, actually, first of all, before we go into what we feel like we are, you know, in order to figure out your number, we've read and you've suggested, you know, the best way to figure out your number, you know, we've found is to read about it with people you love and that you're close to. Mm-hmm. And then we've also read that the test online is great, but I know there's several of them. Would you want to tell us and the people, like, what's the best way to figure out your number, in your opinion?
Sure. So yes. There are a lot of folks in the professional community who get a little fussy and grumpy about the tests.
And
they think the tests are really an unhelpful way to bring your type forward. Just because, you know, this every test is going to have it's cultural, it's racial, even it's type bias. And these inherent bias are going to sort of shape what the tests result on. Secondly, we like to test the tests. We like to try to figure out what we're supposed to say or who we want to be or how we want to be projected as. So if you're going to go after a test, and I don't discourage people from taking the test, but if you're going to go after a test, I think the Enneagram Institute's test, the RETI, RETI is probably the best one out there. It costs a little bit, but it's worth it.
Yeah, and I think it's like $12 or something.
Yeah, it's pretty cheap. $12. That's the one we took. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. These folks have done their homework. They've continued to tighten and perfect this over the years.
Hmm. Yeah,
and it's pretty reliable.
So if you're gonna take a test, the RETI test by the Enneagram Institute is the best way to do it. but leveling up from that, would you agree that kind of discussion among community with friends, with loved ones, with people that know you the most. Would that be a great way?
So I will say this about the test too, just a caution.
Yeah.
The tests are only designed to bring forward or highlight your dominant type.
Yeah.
So don't get confused if they sort of show you how all your types tested out or scored out or how it's stratified or stacked. Just look at the first number. And if that doesn't land, if that doesn't feel right, if you feel like that just isn't getting at it, then either find another test and give it another go. Or like you said, I do think reading the thick descriptions of each of the types with real compassion for yourself generally allows one of them to sort of show itself to us. Now, I sort of joke around that it's the one that you least want to be.
Yeah.
It's the one that hurts the most.
Yeah.
The most humiliating to your ego that's probably getting close.
Mm-hmm.
And so find a teacher, find a school that you believe in and read their descriptions of the type. That always helps. But you're also right.
Yeah.
I do think this. I think working with somebody who knows you, working with somebody who knows themselves and has actually been working on themselves with this tool for a while.
Yeah.
Is a real safe and gentle and again, compassionate way to sort of help bring type forward.
That's good. So I think this is a good segue real quick. So Audrey, when did we find out about this Enneagram? When's the first time we did this? Probably almost a year ago.
Maybe a year and a half.
Yeah.
So we're pretty new still.
We're pretty new, but we've been pretty hot on it, specifically Audrey, for quite a while. And one of those reasons is because it's been immensely useful for how Audrey and I understand one another, how we interact with one another and the outside world, but specifically inside our own marriage and our own relationship. I'm like, I can finally understand why Audrey is doing this or why she's not doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise with Audrey. Now, you know, we've kind of established for sure that Audrey's an eight, right?
Yeah. There was not really a lot of question.
No
for
question.
For me, it was kind of like a year and a half ago when I was with some friends talking about it, I was like, yep, that's me. There was no doubts.
And we established that I was a five for sure. And we kind of had no
doubt.
We were locked in on that. We were diving in and discussing. And then it wasn't until, Chris, we spoke on the phone, you know, a few weeks ago.
For the first time.
You challenged us to make sure we're not misdiagnosing.
Before we have you on the podcast.
And so we dove in, and for some reason, a light turned on, and we were like, oh my goodness, Jer, you're not a five, you're a nine. And then as we read the nine, I started just like my heart started sinking a little bit more because I'm going to be honest, I didn't really like what I heard.
Wanted to be a five.
and so my question is kind of, you know, can you change? I know you can't change numbers specifically like in this amount of time, but is there a sense of growing in and out of them? Have you always been a number? What, you know, can you kind of talk about that real quick?
And talk a little about misidentifying numbers too.
Yeah, because we misdiagnosed totally. And then now with all clarity, we're like, whoa, like, you know, we're pretty sure that I'm a nine.
Yeah.
Now we're like 99% sure now.
Yeah.
So I misdiagnosed. And is that common? I mean, it's just so interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, this is super duper normal and really, really common. I would say that the general consensus is that most of the folks out there believe that you're born your type, this is nature, not nurture. And I really make that option because I really do believe that we are purposed, that we are born to bring a gift forward. And that's not accidental, that we need you. We need every one of you to show up, to reconnect with your essence, to find alignment with the reason and the why that you're here, because all of our lives matter. And there is an urgency of our presence to help heal the world and to help nurture and nourish the new we that I think we're all yearning to be included in. Right.
That's That's so
you're,
good.
I think you're born your type. And I think that's important because I think this is really important, especially for parents or young parents out there. If you're born your type, then the so-called childhood wounds that you will sometimes see in the Enneagram aren't really wounds. You're not wounding your children and causing them to become a kind of person. My sense of these so-called childhood wounds is that they're really sort of confirmation bias of our type to the youngest, tenderest parts of our ego when we're too small to have the psychological capacity to accurately narrate our reality, and when we don't have language or the kind of memory that will actually give us, I think, a truthful snapshot of what these, I think, real tragic misunderstandings were.
So interesting.
I think you're born your type. I think you stay your type. But this conversation on mistyping, it's actually, I do quite a bit of one-on-one work with people, and a lot of it is in fact helping people discern between a couple, two or three types. And there are very typical pairs that would mistype. So nines and fives, really, really, really common.
Yeah.
In fact, nines are probably the most frequent number that would mistype. And this is for a few reasons. First, because nines and fives are both sort of in Karen Horney's grouping here, which Claudio Naranjo brought together in the Hornavian groups.
They're both
in the detached or withdrawn social style, right? So fives sort of step back in relationship, but they're doing this for security. Nines step back in relationship because they're doing this for inner autonomy. Nines are really good at taking care of everybody else's drama, everybody else's business. They're really good at harmonizing, meeting, arbitrating the exterior world. They just don't want somebody poking around under their own hood
and
in their own heart. Uh-huh. And so they take care of themselves. They don't need a lot of nurturing or protective care. They've learned to do this in their early holding environments for themselves. And so it's hard to understand this if you're not an autonomous style here.
Yeah.
But when the nine actually has a sense of power and control and autonomy over him or herself, they're actually able to give more of themselves back. Right?
Yeah, definitely.
This, go ahead.
But there is a lot of stuff about the nine that, for example, like I don't necessarily enjoy. And I feel like now that I've correctly identified as a nine, I almost have a greater understanding of what I want to do to change. Whereas a five, I was kind of comfortable. Like, yeah, I'm a five. It's okay. Like, you know, let's figure this out. But now that I'm a nine, I'm like, oh my goodness, like I want to get to work on this, this, and this. I want to lead here. I almost feel less pleased with myself. And it's just an interesting feeling I didn't think I would have. But like, if someone wants to change areas, like kind of, you know, is there a way to like, it's just an interesting idea of like, I want to almost change some parts of my number. So how do I move forward with that? Like,
yeah. So this is
that's a loaded question.
That's a loaded question, totally. But this is all new. I just found out I'm a nine here. I'm like, oh my goodness.
Yeah. So hey, one more thing about that and nines mistyping. Look, nines are so understanding and they really do get everyone in their lives. Mm-hmm. And this comes from the so-called childhood wound of the nine, which was a wound of minimizing what was important to them as a way of offering love to what was important to the people in their early holding environment. So that may have been a parent or a caregiver, a sibling. And what the nine did was, in a sense, they scanned their environment. They said, hey, these things are actually more pronounced or need more attention than what I need. And so rather than forgetting what I want, I'm going to sort of ball it up and I'm going to put it in my back pocket and I'm going to leave it there. And that contact, because let's say it's in my back pocket, will constantly remind me that it's there. And this is this mental fixation of the nine, which is sometimes called rumination. But it was really your attempt as a little kid to just be more loving, to be more selfless. Mm-hmm. The problem was, is you were sacrificing yourself. I'm not saying this about you. I'm saying in general for nines, you weren't loving yourself completely. And so to your question, it's also a very normal, common human question. We all allow some of the fragments of our identities to lay claim to the whole of who we think we are or lay claim to the whole of who we want to be.
Wow.
And that's because a lot of us don't welcome every part of ourself. That's because a lot of us don't actually know how to offer compassion to every part of ourself. Mm. That's because we maybe we weren't given sort of a fair shake at what love really meant, because in some of our early holding environments, we thought that loving ourselves was narcissistic or selfish.
Yeah.
Or maybe some of us who were socialized in religious communities had the mistake that we, you know, I think this is true, that God is not as hard on us as we are on ourselves. And we internalize that, and we took the parts of ourselves that we thought weren't acceptable or didn't have permission to be all they were, and we minimalized or marginalized them. So there is aspects of each type that we're all going to have a little discomfort with. But man, when those things are unearthed and unsettled, those are really the first things we get to work on. Those are the first sort of invitations to wholeness, or sort of on ramps to grace, or sort of bookmarks of reminding us of what we've forgotten about the best of ourselves.
I feel immense. I mean, it's just, I've never even remotely, it's kind of funny, because now that like I know about the Enneagram, I'm thinking like, what did I do before this to understand things about me and my life?
You forgot.
Well, yeah, that's a nice feature. I know, but like in general, like what do people do? I mean, it's like, it's just this is so valuable. And I think one thing we really wanted to get across in this episode here is specifically convincing people of the value of just realizing these things about yourself and you know, figuring out what number you are, so that you can press into the things you don't like, press into the things that you are, and become a healthy version of yourself. And in a couple minutes, we're gonna get into kind of a little bit more of the wings and the triad, and just we'll briefly go through that, because you know your book has so much good stuff to say about all that. But before that, I don't know where I've heard this, but
I think a lot of times as believers or Christians, like people can be kind of poo-poo on personality tests and like have some negative things to say about it. But I think like one thing that I've loved about the Enneagram is that like it doesn't put you in a box. It shows you the box that you're already in and how to get out of it. And that's not my quote, but I read that somewhere and I was like, oh, I just love that, because it's so dynamic. It's not limiting. It's just like this deep well of like insight, so that you can figure out yourself, so that you can then figure out how to use your skills and your personality and your strengths and all of that to like be the man or woman of God that you were created to be. So that's one reason that I love it.
This is so interesting.
For sure. And actually Sandra Maitrey, that one of the great authors on sort of an interspiritual aspect of the Enneagram's passions and fixations, says something to that effect. She says, look, type is essentially the prison walls that we've incarcerated our souls in. and some of us really actually love to describe the walls, the thickness, the texture, the color. And so you're right that at a certain point, sort of obsessing with type is still missing the point.
Yes.
It is actually giving more power to personality than essence. Mm-hmm. But you know, this word personality comes from the word persona, which means mask. And here's the bummer. I think most of us would rather wear the mask. Most of us we want to keep it fastened, and we don't want to wake up, and we don't want to do the hard work of coming back home to our true selves. But I say this all the time. To unearth buried treasure is dirty work. Mm-hmm. And if you really want to get in there and get your hands dirty, it's messy. It's stinky. Yeah. It's not easy. And you will be, figuratively speaking, an awful sweaty mess before you even get close. But you have to stay at it.
It's so good and so useful, but it's just as scary and just as hard.
Yeah.
You know, to press in. But kind of like how the nines, you know, almost want to like drift through life, you know, I feel like nines would be the most, I don't want to say rejecting, but fearful, I guess, of pressing in. Was that what?
Well, look, when nines are centered, when nines are rooted, right, this their unobstructed view of reality, and this is what Hamid Ali calls our Enneagram's holy idea, right? This unobstructed view of reality, seeing the world as it should be, even if it's not yet. For the nine, that's holy love. Mm-hmm. And for the nine, they're born to be a source of love, acceptance, embrace, inclusion. And so, yes, you're right. There's something terrifying about that. Because this unstoppable force of love is how we know and experience the divine in all the great world religions, right?
Yeah.
A very sacred text that tells us that God is love. And so this is one of the important roles that the nine plays is the reminder of our inherent intrinsic dignity and value, that it's ascribed, not earned. And that's what love does. It always offers.
This is so interesting because that's very well said. My mind keeps going to like the church, right? Like if we're born kind of a specific way, we're born with our spiritual gifts, you know, and we're supposed to bring those, we're supposed to live into those and press into those for the, you know, the body. And I don't know, my brain is just making a weird connection here with like the body of Christ. And this is a total tangent side thing, but I just keep thinking about that every time you're talking about being fearful of pressing in, you know, having to learn about it, you know, so that it can be beneficial. But then there's, I don't know, maybe that's a whole tangent there. My brain's running with that. But anyways.
Well, the imagery is good and it's important imagery for a nine because eights, nines, and ones are what are called the gut types or the instinctive types and this way of processing and perceiving reality. And of the eights, nines, and ones, these three body types, the nine is actually the most disconnected from their own body. And so any totems, any symbols that actually help you get back into your body are going to be really powerful to work with, to pray with, to bring into your contemplative or meditative practices.
So what about like a nine and an eight?
Yeah. So, okay. So we're curious. And I think our listeners will be curious too. Just like, first of all, like, I'd love to ask you, like, are there numbers that are more, I hate to use the word compatible, but are there numbers that are more compatible or less compatible? And what do you think about our pairing of numbers, like eights and nines, and what would be some of our strengths and some of our pitfalls?
Sure. So I don't think that it's like that, you know, there's magnetic poles and there's sort of the anti-pole.
Yeah.
With numbers. I think there are some numbers that have natural resonance with one another because there's sort of a shorthand of understanding. And so you would see this, let's say, with ones, fours, and sevens. They're all a type of frustrated idealist. And what happens is when they're together, they can sort of go on vacation from their own frustration while still admiring the idealism of the other. And so you see that, eights, nines, and ones, these are our body types. There's a shorthand there. There's all different ways to see the gifts and the challenges in any two of these numbers coming together. Now for an eight, you know, and if somebody out there doesn't know what the eight is sometimes called the challenger, the contrarian.
Yeah.
The eight is the type who hates bullies, but they sometimes can be the biggest bully. and this is also a malformed part of their own tenderness. This is also how they're sort of suffering to be loved. Because in the eight's childhood, they felt like something had to be sacrificed. Some part of them had to grow up. And in that acceleration, there was a snapshot, a glimpse of their own innocence that was lost. And so what eights do then as young adults and into their adulthood is they really put this tough, really driven, strong initiating energy out there to protect their own vulnerability. And what they do then is just like all of us in nine different ways, they project that. They project that outside of themselves. And so eights very typically will be incredible champions of the underdogs. They'll be incredibly compassionate for folks who've been marginalized. They'll somehow just melt around children or puppies. And not simply because of our sheep or the tenderness of anything, is reminding the A of their own tenderness, their own innocence, that it's okay, that if you bring that out, you're not weak. In fact, that's where your strength lies.
Mm. Oh, that's so interesting.
Eights would rather, and I say this all the time, we would rather use transparency as a hustle for vulnerability. We'd rather try to scare you off by telling you all the terrible things about us, or pushing and provoking and teasing and sassing, than to really be vulnerable, right? Because this word vulnerable comes from the Latin word for wound, and to be vulnerable means to be woundable. And for an eight, whatever their perception of what was lost in their childhood is an ongoing wound, and it's a wound of their innocence. And so look, don't pick on your friends who are eights. They're not bullies. They're just protecting the vulnerability outside themselves that they feel is being exploited or taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. So for an eight, it's really coming back to your own vulnerability. It's actually finding your own tenderness. It's being reintroduced to your inner child, right?
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things that really hit home with me and my number is when I was reading about it, what feels like intimidation to you feels like intimacy to an eight. And for me, like, that was like, oh my gosh, that is me. Like, for me, conflict is connection, because if I can ask people the hard questions and I can like kind of push their buttons a little bit, I get to see what they're really made of. And I get to then like have this moment of connection, even if there's conflict in the course of it. It usually leads to like intimacy and resolve, because I don't know if this is an eight thing either, but I'm also like very much, especially in our own marriage, like the resolver. Like, I might engage in conflict, but then it has to have closure. It has to have, you know, some sort of resolve. I won't let it like linger on.
Yeah, where I can just forget it.
Whereas Jeremy just is like,
and then ask, never mind. Ask Audrey where we're going to dinner, like nothing happened.
Exactly.
Yeah. And
yes. So
that happens all the time.
Yeah.
I sometimes say that conflict or sass or provocative, like the provocative nature of the A is their love language. It is how they build trust. It is how they subconsciously test people. And they're testing, I try to describe it like this. They're testing the thickness of the ice between them and their conversation partner. So yes, if I mess with you a little bit, if I come across a little bit too aggressive, if I'm a little bit too inappropriate, is this going to break the ice? Because let's break the ice now. Let's get this over with so that you don't hurt me, betray me, walk away from me later on when you find out there's so much more inside the intense little heart of the eight, right? Mm-hmm. So for an eight and a nine, that's got to be lots of fun for the people in your life to observe.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Because the eight is really one of the most aggressive, if not the most aggressive, of the Enneagram types. And the nine is really one of the most withdrawn, and they're sometimes perceived to be detached of the types.
So, so I want to hang out here a little bit and talk about this, because that has manifested itself in literally every single area of our relationship. Like, even from when we were dating, the walls Audrey had up, you know, and all the way in now, like marriage, of course, like all of our fights, I tend to handle them in a very methodical, thoughtful, calm,
non-reactive.
I do not react.
Patient.
Super patient. Almost to the point where frustratingly, almost to the point where I might even forget about it. But then I'll come up with a solution, but it'll be like 2 weeks later and I'll pick up the conversation. Like,
like it was then, just happening.
And that drives Audrey mad. And in the same way, I can't tell you how many times we've gotten in a heated discussion and I'm like, babe, you need to control yourself and calm down. We need to tone down a little bit, you know, because her escalating you know, intimidation tactics drives me mad. And so
it just pushes him Enneagram, further to shut down.
Yeah. And this, again, I'm getting circling back to the value of the Enneagram, because like knowing this about one another has been immensely helpful
for
like,
conflict resolution for sure.
Yeah, even for like our goals and dreams and like how we approach them and tackle them. And you know, Aj and I, we work together, you know, we spend all day with one another, so figuring out how we work together or interact with one another has been immensely valuable. So yeah, that's just a little note on the value.
Yeah.
Of it.
So there's so much we could do here with eights and nines, because, all right, first of all, if anybody sort of, you know, from the outside looks at the Enneagram, they would think, like I've said, that the eights are maybe the type with the most presence. And there is a drive there. And that drive, like you said, could be the drive towards resolution, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Eights hate to be slowed down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now the funny thing about the nines is they look and appear to sometimes be passive, but actually there is a sort of rumble, like the slow lava of anger that's always sort of burning in their belly that they've hidden from themselves. And so what we always forget about the nines is there's a profound sort of stubbornness there. Mm-hmm. And when you really try to figure this out, it's hard to know who's stronger here. If the eight is really as strong as they come across, or if this is just the protection of their own vulnerability,
interesting.
Or if the nine is strong as strong as they come across, then sort of this meandering, deliberative sort of rooting in. And so when you get that stubbornness and that drive and they collide,
yeah, wow, watch out.
Of course, there's going to be sparks.
Yeah. Now,
how do we contend with those? There's another overlay in the Enneagram called the harmonic groups, and the harmonic groups are our conflict resolution, but it's also our conflict avoidance styles. And this is really funny for eights because the conflict avoidance style for the eight is actually a reactive style. It's a discharging of what's frustrating them. They just got to get it off their chest. They just have to smash the horn, say the curse word, just bark whatever their opinion is. And once they discharge it, they're fine. It's like, I don't have to fight about that. I just had to say it.
Totally, Audrey.
But everybody else doesn't feel like that's a conflict avoidance style. Everybody else feels like they're being baited and drawn into conflict.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So the bummer for the nine is their conflict avoidance style is positive outlook, which is a kind of reframing. And so here comes the eight, and it's like, that son of a gun just cut us off.
Oh, yeah.
And the Absolutely. Nine might say, oh, I don't think they saw you.
Oh,
there's always another side.
Yeah.
Always another way to see it. And that just makes it harder for the eight, who then will come back with
their style. And then for me, I'm like, calm down. Like, I'll almost, you know, hit a cone or whatever it is, or like get really close to, you know, a telephone pole, you know, knowing I'm in control of the car. It's so funny you brought up the car example, because this happened on the way here to the office.
Yeah.
I got really close to a fence and Aj.
I reacted.
She reacts. And I'm like,
what the heck? You almost
why can't
thing?
You calm down knowing, you know, it's okay and everything's fine.
Everything's just always fine for Jer. Like, nothing is a big, if like we got in a motorcycle accident,
but
fine.
But do I need to be healthy for us? Do I need to be a little bit more assertive, or does Audrey need to calm down a little bit more? Like, where do we find this pursuit of pursuit of compatibility?
If you will therapy with us for a minute.
Yeah. So when you, Audrey, discharge what's bumming you out, frustrating you, where what's just sort of pulling on your last nerve. That's actually how eights attempt to sort of self-soothe. This is how we try to calm ourselves down. Like I said, just got to get it off our chest.
Yes.
Like,
they're verbal.
Stop driving so close to the fence.
Yeah.
That's it. They're going to be fine. They just said what they needed to say.
Yep. Let go of it then. Yeah.
But what do I need?
Here's how we do this. When an eight brings that the reactive discharge of energy out, and a nine naturally will counter with a reframing or a positive outlook, or, hey, it could have been worse, or, hey, we're fine. What we need to do is we always need to learn to receive each other's first response and then work with it. So,
oh, interesting.
If you receive Audrey's response like, hey, you're right, I almost hit that fence. Why did I do that? Then she's going to be like, seriously. But then it's as if you've established the trust, because she feels heard, and you can put your arm around her and say, but we're okay.
Yeah. And that was a close one. Yeah.
Now let's sort of find our center again. And Audrey, when he maybe comes at a situation with sort of what you might think is sort of pie in the sky perceptions, or maybe an exaggerating or a apple polishing, and you think he's not really seeing it as he should. You have to learn to receive that as well. Like, oh, you're right. It could be a lot worse. And if he feels heard and trusted, it's like you put your arm around him, and then you can step forward and say, but hey, we do need to remember.
Yes.
And the first step is always the receiving.
Yeah, the first step.
As a way of embrace.
That's
the receiving
really good.
As a way of connecting. Because then the second step can bring clarity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that right there is really good. The first step in how we react to our partners will plot the direction for the second, third, and fourth step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we always want to, actually, you're right. We always want to get to the third and fourth step. But we have to know that it's safe to even go that far in conflict, in conversation, in becoming vulnerable with each other. So it's just learning to receive what the other one gives. And one of my teachers, Wes Hudson, he'll call these styles, these conflict avoidance styles, he calls them love offerings.
That's so good.
The eight discharges, that's their love offering.
It's like a
because
gift.
On a subconscious level, they're saying, I actually don't want to fight about this, so just let me get it off my chest. When the nine offers their gift, this love offering of positive outlook, they're also saying, look, I don't want to fight, so let's not go there. And so if we can learn to receive the love offering, that's part of building intimacy or trust. But we have to realize this, that these love offerings, these gifts are still malformed, and we all need the other perspectives. And so in receiving the gift, now you have, let's say, earned the ability to offer an alternative perspective.
So good.
Wow. Yeah.
I feel like we need to camp out here forever.
We need to learn to receive each other's, you know, sure. Like your response could be overly reactive and mine could be overly unreactive, but at the same time we're offering a gift to one another, and we need to learn to receive each other's responses as gifts or whatever it is. You know, of course that's broad brushstrokes there, but like that's such a good approach. Wow.
The other thing that I think eights and nines in intimate relationships can build off of is you both do have a fundamental social need for autonomy. And so there is a sense of respecting each other's space. And what can be really healthy in that is there may not be sort of the typical kind of emotional fusion where you lose your sense of self in one another. And so if you can really own who you are, your gifts, your strengths, what's beautiful and fabulous about you, you're really capable of bringing two distinct persons into the relationship, which of course is more than the sum of its parts. The problem, or let's say the challenge of two folks in relationship who need autonomy also may sometimes mean that there could be barriers for asking for what you want and what you need, and barriers for actually allowing yourself to receive what you really want if you feel like it's safe to bring that forward. And then you may also have some challenges around negotiating intimacy, because just because you have this need for autonomy doesn't mean that intimacy isn't important to you. It just means that you see it very differently. And we see it differently from nine perspectives. But for the eight, it has to be safe. And for the nine, there has to be a unity in it. There has to be a healing of what's been fragmented.
This is so valuable
to feel like intimacy is going to actually lead to flourishing in a relationship.
Really, really good stuff, Chris. Okay. We want to ask, we didn't really dive into this too much, but I think a lot of people, we kind of poll our audience and we get a lot of questions about this whenever we talk about the Enneagram, and that is the whole concept of the wings. So how can you be a wing that's, from what the way I understand it, your wing is either up a number or down a number. So how do you determine your wing? And do some people not have wings?
Yes. Good question. And sorry, Audrey, I do want to say this too, because I have so much compassion for female eights, especially in religious communities, because I think it may be one of the hardest types to be.
A female eight, that is? A female eight, that is, or an eight?
Female eight.
A female eight. They're often not allowed to bring their whole selves. They sometimes show up and can really be threatening to specifically men who don't know themselves or who don't know how to interact with a powerful, strong woman. And and so it's one of the types out there that we have to really honor and make room for. And
that's interesting.
Good for you, Audrey. Get at it.
Oh, get at it.
And keep at it.
Keep at it. There we go. Because she is at it.
Oh man. Yeah. So the wings. I joke around that the Enneagram is worse than religion when it comes to sort of its doctrinal or denominational or sort of theoretical divides.
Interesting.
And it's funny because like something as simple as the wings, right?
Yeah.
Should be pretty straightforward, but there's at least a half a dozen sort of camps out there and folks who want to fight about this. Now, Audrey, when you mentioned this, I loved how you said that. It's either a number up or down, right? The wings are the numbers adjacent to yours. It's the numbers beside yours around the circle. So if you're an eight, Audrey, your wings would be 7 and 9. Jeremy, if you're 9, your wings would be 8 and 1. And the various theories out there would say that, you know, first of all, there are some folks who just don't believe in the wings. That's just not part of understanding type.
Interesting.
My sense is that the Enneagram is a color wheel and that these numbers bleed into each other going around the circle. And my sense is that you can lean into either or both of these wings as they serve to support you bringing the best of yourself forward. And just like wings, I think we need both of them for balance. I think we need both of them for movement.
That resonates.
Yeah.
One of my teachers, Michael Goldberg, this is the man who saw the Enneagram show up in Homer's book, The Odyssey, and in Homer's 9 stops on his way home in order, starting at point 9, counterclockwise around the circle. Michael Goldberg says it's there, and it really is. You can't unsee it. Well, Michael says that you're clockwise wing is your ally point, and this is what you reach into to sort of pull the best parts of yourself out, and that your counterclockwise wing is your shadow point. This is where you've hidden some of the best parts of yourself
that need to be reintroduced. Interesting. I have not heard that.
My teacher, Father Richard, would say the more mature and aware and centered you become, the less visible your dominant type is, the more visible your wings are. And then, you know, in this really great, little nerdy, but really great trade publication called the Enneagram Monthly, there was a Colombian doctor a few years ago who put an article out there that said, if he looked at your fingerprints, he could tell what your dominant type and your dominant wing are. I think he tried to test it and prove it. And I was like, oh, this isn't real. And then I looked and I was like, no, he totally got me.
Got it. Wow.
So there's so many ideas
crazy
out there.
Yeah.
But I think your wings are, they just help enhance who you are. It's like a color wheel. It just brings more texture and depth and beauty forward. And so I say this to everybody, whatever theory, whatever, you know, idea that you find most practical and applicable to work with, start there.
Yeah.
Work with it until it no longer serves you and then see if there's something beyond that.
Yeah.
Good. That's really well put. Yeah.
That's really good.
Yeah. Very interesting. Wow.
I love what you said about the clockwise and counterclockwise.
Yeah. I never heard that. That's good.
That was really good. Yeah. I feel like this is an endless conversation. because it's so useful. It's just so helpful to dive into kind of the whys and hows of how we operate. Mm.
And Audrey and Jeremy, one other gift in your relationship is that you share connections, because that point nine will have an eight wing and that point eight will have a 9 wing. And so there is going to be some natural unspoken understanding where you sometimes just get it. And you may just even get it with a touch or a look.
Totally.
But you can grow in fluency even in that. You can learn to even make those sort of non-verbal connections as you
That's true.
Sort of scrub the accent of those off.
Totally.
That's so true.
Well, Chris, so we know you've got a book, The Sacred Enneagram. We'd love to, you know, have you just talk about that real quick. For anyone that's listening, it's really a good dive in to, I would say, kind of the more, I don't want to say technical, but just in-depth aspects of the Enneagram. So, you know, you can talk about your book for just a moment, Chris. And also, we'd love to hear any other books, podcasts, or people that you would suggest following or reading about if people are interested in learning more about the Enneagram.
Sure. So So one of my teachers, Russ Hudson, will say this. He'll say something to the effect that the Enneagram is less about nine types of people, more about nine paths to God. And I love that notion. And so if it really is about nine paths to God, then what are those? And so I spent several years trying to sort of test that to sort of figure that out. And I really thought that if you do come to understand the sense of your type, it shows you really, I think, the rails for how to nurture and nourish your spirituality, to do your soul work, to make your connections with love and with God. And so in the Sacred Enneagram, that's really what I'm up to. I'm trying to say, what are these nine unique paths to spiritual growth? What are these nine unique paths to finding your way home? And I think it's been really freeing for people, right? I sort of grew up in a typical mega church where, you know, we'd walk in and it was 20 or 30 minutes of group karaoke.
They took up a
collection and we paid the cover. We listened to a lecture sort of high-fived our way out. And that was it. And that didn't work for me. Like
that worked for a lot of people.
That did not work for me.
Don't get Jeremy started on
that
one.
Don't get me started on that.
So I'm trying to say, like, once you know your type, that's great, but what do you do with it? And I'm suggesting you actually now take that into connecting back with love, with God, with your true self. And there's nine ways to do this. There's nine ways to get there. I don't have to do it like my wife does it. And she doesn't have to do it like some of our colleagues and community members do it. And it's freeing. And it reminds us how unique and dynamic and special each of us are. So
amen. Love
try
that.
To do that. I try to make it really, really, really practical.
Awesome.
So good. Well, thank you, Chris, so much. We have, at the end of our podcast, we like to do this like rapid fire behind the scenes take on our guests. So if you'll humor us for a second, we have like three rapid fire questions that you can answer like probably pretty quickly if you're up for it.
Sure.
It's a little bit going into your dirty laundry, but
No. It's just useful. One of them's really useful. The other ones, yeah, they're all useful.
So,
go for
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Okay. So the first question is, what does your morning routine look like?
Oh man, I am a wreck in the morning. what's consistent is typically taking my puppy down to one of the city parks in Midtown and letting them hunt around for rabbits. And then I come back and I am a diva about most of the things I eat. Like for fun, I will sometimes take chefs who are friends on street food tours of South and Southeast Asia. So I am very particular about how my eggs are prepared. And my dog is also very particular about how his eggs are prepared. So I make eggs for me and my puppy. And Felina actually can't make them for either of us.
Oh my gosh. That is hilarious. So
almost the most
that is a little diva.
I love it. All right. Funny. Okay, question number two is, what is the best life hack that you've ever discovered?
That's a hard one.
I do like holding down the space bar on my iPhone and turning that into a mouse.
What
are you talking about?
Oh yeah, that's a game
stop
changer.
Pulling this up.
I love
pulling
that
this
one.
Up right now.
No way.
But
okay, that is a life hack.
That's so funny because I'm sort of joking about that. Like, that's my favorite little like handy trick.
That's what we're asking.
But I think my real life hack is just like leaning into friends, letting people be mirrors back to the parts of myself that I've forgotten or that I have a hard time accepting or finding compassion for. So
such a good,
such a good. That's very Enneagram-esque of you.
Yeah, no.
No.
All right. Last question is, we call this roses and thorns. So what is your rose and thorn from the week? Or in other words, what is like your high from the week and your low from the week?
Man, it's so I travel a lot with my work. Like I'm on about 130 flights a year. And so so when I'm home, I know this sounds stupid, and I hate the person I've become. I even hate myself for saying this. But my dog just reminds me what it means to be in the present moment, that this moment actually matters, and that in this moment there is the capacity for awareness and for love. And so it's so silly to say this.
That's good.
Goofy, but I love my dog. I love being around this little
That's
guy.
That's good. That's awesome.
The hard part of my week actually came up in my spiritual direction session with my spiritual director the other day. And as usual, it's what we hate the most in someone else that we've unresolved in ourselves. And I was having I felt like I was struggling to offer compassion for this particular person who we had a misunderstanding, when in fact it's just the part of myself that I still can't accept. And I for sure don't have compassion for. So it's a bummer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Chris,
it's been an absolute honor.
This has been really great. And I feel like it's really useful for everyone listening. So thanks. Where can our followers find you?
So you can, so the little nonprofit that I run now, it's called Gravity. It's a center for contemplative activism. And we're simply just helping people who help people. We're on the other side of the humanitarian work, trying to work with activists, practitioners, human trafficking survivors, and other folks trying to make the world a better place. And so that's at gravitycenter.com. You can find out where we're hosting Enneagram workshops and trainings at sacredenneagram.org. And you can see pictures, an obnoxious amount of pictures of my dog on Instagram.
There we go. Okay.
That's the behind the scenes. That's what we want.
There we go. Yeah. Well, Chris, again, it's been awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris, so much.
For sure. Y'all are doing important work. So keep adding.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thanks for including me.
Yeah. Thank you.